There's a river flowing in my soul.
In the additional conversation with Stephanie Jones, we explored how development lives inside everyday interactions, relationships, emotional experiences, and reflective practice. We explored the idea that development is not something separate from ordinary life in schools and communities, but development unfolds through it. This additional conversation with Mary Helen Imoduni Yang invites us to widen that lens even further. Not simply to ask, how do students learn, but what is learning ultimately for? And perhaps even more fundamentally, how do human beings become who they are through the experience of learning? Mary Helen's work sits at the intersection of neuroscience, developmental psychology, education, emotion, culture, and meaning making. And one of the extraordinary things about her work is that she helps us see that thought itself is deeply human. Thinking is not detached from emotion, not detached from relationships, not detached from culture, identity, ethics, or lived experience. Instead, these processes are deeply intertwined in the developing mind and brain. One of the most powerful ideas running through this conversation with Mary Helen is that the experience of thinking matters. What does it feel like to think here in this school and this classroom with these people about these questions under these conditions? Because according to Mary Helen's work, those experiences and the sense people make of them are not peripheral to development. They are developmental. They shape identity, motivation, they shape purpose and future orientation, and the ways young people come to understand themselves and their relationships to the world. You'll hear Mary Helen discuss transcendent thinking, young people's developing capacity to think beyond the immediate situation towards questions of systems, justice, identity, history, ethics, future possibilities, and collective life, and how that matters intellectually and also in terms of people's long-term well-being. And she argues something profoundly important, that these forms of reflection and meaning-making are not educational luxuries. They are central to the developmental processes of adolescence itself. This conversation challenges us to imagine schools not simply as places where information is delivered, but as places where human beings develop their sense of self, their capacity to reflect, their capacity to engage complexity, their sense of agency and responsibility, and their capacity to participate meaningful in a shared democratic world. And underneath all of that is a deeply hopeful idea that young people are already driven to make meaning, already driven to ask bigger questions. The question is whether schools can create the conditions that support young people becoming or suppress it. These are questions that are both deeply scientific and deeply human, and I can think of no better guide for this conversation than Mary Helen Imoduni Yang. Mary Helen, thanks so much for joining us. As every time I hear you speak, I learn more.
It's a pleasure to be here, David, and likewise.
Yesterday, you gave for the National Academy of Education a wonderful webinar, which we will provide a link to here. And one of the things you said in that webinar that I thought was very important is, in my paraphrase, that learning serves development. It's not just that development serves learning, but learning serves and drives development. Please unpack that powerful statement.
I think that statement really comes out of my trying to really grapple with and reckon with the way we understand the purpose of schools. And really something that we've been discussing as a kind of, I know it's corny to say, but like a Kuhnian or a Copernican shift many people are talking about these days. If you think about yourself standing on the world as the middle of the solar system or the universe, and you're looking up in pre-Copernican times, and you're watching the heavenly bodies go by, and they mainly go from east to west, and you can predict that pretty regularly. But then you got Mars going retrograde, and you got a random comet shooting across from the completely wrong direction, and you can't, with Earth as the center of the solar system perspective, you can't really accommodate those observations. And so you kind of have to add a lot into your model, slap some growth mindset intervention on Mars, get it back going the way it's supposed to go, and that kind of thing. And it's not that it's incorrect to conceptualize the Earth as the center of the solar system. That's a perfectly reasonable way to describe things. You could make the center anything arbitrary, but it's not a very parsimonious or useful way to do it. And when you realize that a more useful conceptual model is to think of the sun at the center and us, like the other planets, moving around it, all of a sudden, so many things make more sense. The reason why Mars looks like it's going backwards, the reason why you could have something coming from a completely different direction. And I think we need to make that kind of conceptual shift in education. So currently, what is the center? The center is the learning outcomes and the administrative practices and institutional structures that support the activities that we call school. And then we're standing on that platform and watching the kids' learning outcomes go by and thinking, wow, that kid's way going retrograde. We got to do something about that. And I have no idea this kid over here who's the comet just shooting completely out of left field. If we were to reconceptualize the center of the enterprise as the experience of thinking, what does it feel like to think here? What does it feel like to think about these things in this context with these people under these conditions? Then I think so much more would make sense. Because what the neuroscience and psychological science together are showing us is that the way in which thinking subjectively is experienced and engaged in determines, and I know that's a strong word, that's beyond the data, but that's my interpretation, and it's very consistent with what we're finding. The feeling of the thinking, the engagement with the processes is what determines how the process of learning and of thinking over time shapes developmental outcomes, changes who you are in that space, how you experience yourself, how you imagine your potential, how you invent possible futures for yourself in the world, how you position yourself relative to scholarly skills, the community, civic engagement, and all of that coming together in a purposeful way for you. So when I say that I think we've gotten the outcome and sort of the cart before the horse, we have put in education so much emphasis on what is in the horse's cart. We have to know fractions and reading, and that is true. You do need to know fractions and how to read and all these things. But those learning outcomes or milestones don't tell you anything about the horse itself who's pulling that cart. And we need to spend much more attention on who is the horse. Are they willing? Are they interested? Are they freaked out and scared by the wind or by the trees rustling? Are they wanting to move forward? Are they interested in pulling that cart? And where are they going? And that, to me, is the ultimate aim in education. The ultimate aim in education is not learning. Learning is the means. Learning is the way by which we get to the ultimate aim. And the ultimate aim, I would argue, is human development. It's the development of the people in the system. How do these people come to experience themselves, their potentials, the future, the world, disciplinary ways of understanding differently than they would have? And how does that position them to be and act in ways into the future differently than they would have done had they not had these opportunities to learn? And those are really the core questions that I think the field needs to grapple with.
This is very profound. And here's what I would add to it. The more I feel good as I'm learning or whatnot in different ways, the more I do it, and the more that enables me to continue to learn and continue to develop and
Absolutely,
so
that's
forth.
exactly right.
We're developing that momentum, which is also a
Yes.
set of muscular experiences.
Yes,
really
that's
enable
right.
me to keep on
Dispositions
doing.
of mind, I would call
Yes,
them.
yeah. And it's very powerful. I also think, and we may get into this now, that I think what you're talking about is not just what is positioning them, students individually, but positioning
Absolutely.
students collectively,
Yes.
and not just to act on the world, but to act together on the world. And that's where transcendent thinking even becomes more important and very
Yes.
much connected to this whole series.
Yeah.
This is for a book I'm writing with Juliet Berg for education leaders. And I said, one of the things to do, among other things, is we want to let them think about other people's perspectives. And I don't know
Yes.
if you've seen or read a play by Tom Spofford called Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. Hamlet isn't the only story.
Yeah.
And what we need to know is there are all those stories that are going on, and they're all co-equally powerful, even though in different ways, because some people have
Right.
more resources to position their voice.
So, David, I think what you're doing is really showing us exactly what I mean, which is what is education for? It's for human development. It empowers us and situates us on a trajectory throughout the life course that you use to manage yourself adaptively, dynamically, civically, socially, culturally in the world. And our schools are the place where we offer young people the opportunity to engage with each other and with ideas that they may not have other
Yeah.
opportunities to bump into naturally moving through other places in the world. And what you're really showing is the power of your own education, right, to launch you on a life course trajectory that is infinitely evolving, constantly renewing and adapting all the way along.
Mary Helen, your recent work suggests that adolescents' tendency to think beyond the immediate situation towards systems, values, identity, justice, purpose, and a sense of future predicts later brain development and psychological thinking. And you call this transcendent thinking. Why do you call it transcendent thinking? And should we think about this as an enrichment opportunity or as a developmental need?
I want to start by saying there's at least a century of developmental science that describes the ways that young people agentically come to make meaning of their own situations, of the world, of ideas, of concepts, and the really profound developmental milestones and processes that adolescents engage in around becoming with a real focus on ideas, on identities, on things that you can't immediately see in the here and now. They're complex stories and feelings and beliefs and histories and values that travel with people, that become the core of their interpretive lens, their starting point for engaging with the world. And I called that transcendent thinking in our study as a way to signal not that we've invented something new, we haven't at all, but that there is a sort of shared cognitive and affective process that exists across many kinds of psychological and psychosocial phenomena that have been well described as core to the experience of adolescence, things like purpose, things like abstract thinking, things like identity development, things like civic orientation, conceptual development in disciplinary spaces. And what all of these share, complex perspective taking, right? What all of these share from a kind of neural perspective is, if you will, a leap from managing oneself in the here and now, noticing things, remembering things, interacting appropriately, and making direct inferences from the things that are actually existing around you, so to speak, and leaping beyond the here and now to the bigger causes, the why, the how, the intentions, the stories that undergird the ways in which things are structured and happen, the parts that you can't directly see that are about what this means for the future, what I learn from it about the nature of the world, about questioning not just what is, but why it's that way and says who and how else could it be. And those kinds of processes together needed a name because they exist through many domains of psychosocial and emotional and cognitive and moral development, but they share a common construal level, if you will, that is what I wanted to capture, because I thought it was that leap beyond the here and now that we would be able to operationalize in the neural activity. Because the brain doesn't process little different kinds of information in different places. That's just, it's a much more networked, dynamic, emergent kind of processing than we had ever really appreciated decades ago. And what we did in the experiment was to invite 65 young people from across neighborhoods of the city that have low socioeconomic resources, high proportions of youth of color, and all of the kids in the study had at least one parent who was born and raised to adulthood outside of the US. And these people were from 14 different countries. I figured these kids would be kids who could really show us something about the thinking they've done about the world, about negotiating multicultural spaces, bicultural spaces, becoming an American, and what that means to them in a household where their parents recently become American, right? These very dynamic kinds of complexities that these kids would have witnessed and experienced. And so I wanted to start with them when we looked at the ways in which a young people's social meaning making may be a factor in their own developmental trajectory. Up until this point, there was a lot of research on the development of the brain, and there's increasing research that's very good that co basically correlates brain development with life circumstances, right? So IQ and things, so, capacities, metrics that describe the person's capacities, and then also things about neighborhood and about socioeconomic status and about the kinds of social experiences a person has had. What I wanted to look at was the role that young people play in organizing their own mental and brain development through the way in which they dispositionally grapple with the things they witness and experience and learn about in the world. And so, what we did was we invited these kids from all over the city to come and spend one day with us in the lab. And then we brought them back 2 years later for another day with us in the lab. And then we followed them for 3 more years all the way into their young adulthood. So, these were mid-adolescence, early high school, 14 to 17 years old at the beginning, 14 to 18 years old. And then we followed them for 5 years. And what we found was quite both strikingly predictable and extraordinarily revealing at the same time. What we found is that when we talk to kids about their own understanding, the feelings they had about the things they had witnessed in the world. So we, in one of the interviews we had with them, we talked to them about all kinds of things that were going on in their life, the things they had witnessed, the ideas they had to make the world better, who they wanted to be in 10 years, how they understood how they were being parented, all these kinds of things. But then we sat each one down to a 2-hour private videotaped interview where we shared with them sequentially a series of 40 mini documentary stories that we had compiled and organized together that featured the real life situations of teenagers from around the world. So there was no actors, nothing made up. And so we just shared with them a story. There's a girl in this place called Pakistan. Have you heard of that? There's this group called the Taliban, and here's what they think. And this girl wants to go to school and become a doctor, but she's not allowed to go to school because this group that's controlling her city right now doesn't believe in girls' education. So here's a video of her explaining how she feels and thinks about that with her dad. Watch the video and then ask the kid, how does this person's story make you feel? And then there were a whole range of stories in there, and all of them were chosen specifically to be about kids in other places, so that every kid in the experiment would really, at least for most of the stories, have to really grapple with things they hadn't maybe known before. And we just asked them, how does it make you feel? And what kids showed us is that their dispositions to answering that question revealed not only correlations to real-time neural dynamics as they then moved into the MRI scanner and watched those stories again and told us in real time by pushing buttons how emotionally engaged they were with thinking about each one, but also enabled us to actually predict the future growth of their brain structurally, functionally, in every way that we measured. And these future growth trajectories were controlling for the starting point of the brain, right? So, in other words, here's Mary Helen's brain at age 15. Here's how she's thinking about the world and really showing her willingness to grapple with the complexities of what she could learn from other people's situations and really think about why is it that way? And what are the lessons I could learn? Or how could I help? Or just all kinds of things that are transcendent, that move beyond the here and now. And then here's my brain at age 15 when I do that. And then I come back 2 years later at age 17 and we compare my brain at age 17 to my brain at age 15 and look at the change controlling for the starting point. And when we actually compare kids to each other, we don't directly, at a time point, we don't see anything really striking. But when we compare the growth that kids have experienced over the 2 year interval between the scans, that is where we find a highly robust effect that's independent of IQ, independent of parents' socioeconomic status, independent of their parents' education levels, right? Independent of gender, independent of the ethnic group that the young person is from. And what we showed is that young people's disposition to think transcendently, their tendency in whatever way they wanted to grapple with what else this story means beyond just, oh, I feel bad for this person, or oh, that's great, or wow, watch her, that's cool, right? Or I want to help her, poor her. To really think about, wait a minute, you're telling me not everybody in the world gets to go to school, even when there are schools available, because someone else decided they don't think it they should? That's not right. And starts to go from there, right? And thinking about what does that mean for my own ability to go to school? What does it mean for how the world should be in general, for what I believe in, what I should work for, what I'm inspired to become? And what we showed is that the more kids did that, and by the way, every young person in our experiment did at least some of that. So they can do it, right? Which is, and then it becomes what my colleague and dear friend Barbara Rogoff calls the do theory, right? It's not what you can do, it's what you actually do. It's what you do that determines how you grow yourself over time. What we think is that these young people were showing us that they move through the world curious about why things are the way they are and interested in understanding what they can learn from those things, how they could contribute, what they could take away, how they could then move forward in a purposeful way, and what they believe in and stand for. And those ways of engaging with the world in predicted brain growth, which the brain growth in turn predicted identity development in, at age 19 or so. So, in other words, the degree to which just standard updated Erikson type questionnaires, the degree to which young people report that, yeah, I spend a lot of time and effort really thinking about the person I want to become, and I share my ideas and get feedback and think about this together with people who I trust and who love me, right? As compared to saying, I just kind of hang with the crowd. I rarely do things on my own. I go along with what everybody else thinks is good, kind of thing. And that identity development at age 19 in turn predicted all kinds of really critical psychosocial outcomes in their early 20s in young adulthood. Things like very basic things like how much do you like the young adult you've become, the person you've become? Slide a little slider bar. I really love myself. I really love who I am. I really hate who I am, right? Slide that slider bar back and forth. Or here's a list of all the people you might have in your life, your neighbor, your friend at school, your parent, your teacher, your boss at work, your partner, maybe even your own child, all these things. For all the roles of people you have in your life in that role, how much satisfied are you with the quality of that relationship? Slide a little slider bar. How much do you think what you're doing with your life right now, work or school, whatever, is what you always hope for yourself and you are really enjoying it and really succeeding and achieving the way you want to, right? Those are the outcomes that were predicted in this developmental cascade of effects from transcendent thinking in adolescence, mid-adolescence, through the brain development. And you could not skip any of the predictors in the model. You can't just take transcendent thinking score and predict a young adult psychosocial outcomes. The kids have to show you over time that they're doing the work of grappling and growing their brains. And in turn, grappling and growing their selves, and in turn, grappling and growing their lives. It's like exercise for the brain and mind.
And if I am right in terms of Barbara Rogoff's do, you need an opportunity
Yes,
to do
yes.
it. As I was listening to you, I was thinking of a counterfactual. account that comes from sociology and maybe a literature you know or don't know. But in the 1990s and 80s, early part of this millennium, Paul Wills for males and Angela McRobey for working class gals in England really talked about how working class kids remade their working classness within a structure where they actively own their own creation. But if I think if we go back to what is described, then I'd have to go back, they were also not given an opportunity to do the types of things you're talking about, because it was in the UK, but I think it is true for the purpose of education in our country, most young people are not afforded the opportunity to do the type of transcendent thinking that is neurobiologically possible, which gets me again to ask that question. So is this a frill? Is this, should we be having a transcendence class that students can opt into if they're doing okay in school, or should this be more fundamental?
I think whether we like it or not, kids are doing this. A 15-year-old kid comes to school, they might be totally not doing what they're quote unquote supposed to be doing. But tell me their shoes don't mean something bigger than shoes to them. They're like, I walk in here with this haircut and these shoes, and I'm signaling something about who I am, what I stand for, what I believe in, how I think about you, right? The school people, right? Kids are thinking of beyond the here and now. That is the hallmark of adolescent growth. But you're right that many of our most traditional, time-worn, honored structures and belief systems around which secondary school is built do not just not support transcendent thinking in responsible, ethical, complex, disciplinarily informed ways. They actively punish it. Do not ask how else I could interpret this novel, or why we have to read this, or what else this chemistry could be for, or how come we only study the history of these people and not those people, or all of the history is framed in terms of wars. These kinds of questions that really get at the heart of the design of the curriculum, the opportunities that are available to kids. We simply do not have the patience or the developmental sort of proclivity for the most part, although there are amazing educators and there are amazing schools that do this incredibly well. But in the standard system, we do not support teachers and institutions in strategically, responsibly supporting young people in grappling with those kinds of deep, fraught questions that they are most deeply motivated by, and that become the reason why they engage with the disciplinary learning, because they need those skills. When the curriculum is placed well, kids feel they need those skills to be able to be efficacious in acting in their communities on the problems they most care about. And so what we really need, and many people are talking about this now, and schools are struggling and striving to move in this direction. We at Candle are also doing a lot of programming and experimental ways of thinking together with educators about how to support school districts and educators in moving in this direction. What we need is curriculum that positions young people to enter into the kinds of dialogues and to learn to listen to one another and to take complex perspectives, not only within the classroom, but within the historical context of ideas, of skills, of scientific ways of studying, right? All of these become the just-in-time needed tools for grappling with the most important, pressing issues, ideas, and questions that young people are deeply motivated by naturally. And if we redesign around an invitation to safely engage with that kind of thinking, it makes not only the school so much more appealing to young people, but our research and others would suggest that it actually shapes the dispositional ways in which young people come to understand knowledge itself, learning itself, and who they become and are becoming in the world.
You mentioned the work you're doing at Candle. Would you describe Candle for the audience and
Sure.
the important work that it is doing?
Thanks. So CANDLE is the University of Southern California Center for Affective Neuroscience, Development, Learning, and Education. We are a transdisciplinary research center at the university, and we conduct with a deeply interdisciplinary team. We conduct longitudinal studies of young people's psychosocial, cognitive, affective, cultural, and brain development. And we also conduct studies of teachers and teaching. And we work intensively together with policymakers and with practitioners to try to what we call metabolize the science, and also build out re science that reflects developmental science that reflects the most pressing, itchy questions facing our schools and our young people and their families and communities and teachers today. So we work in a deeply interdisciplinary, collaborative way together with practitioners and with young people and with teachers to try to grapple with producing the scientific evidence that speaks to the most pressing, itchy problems we have, and then to figure out, together with diverse educators and policymakers and administrators, how we can metabolize that science into nutrients and energy for meaningful innovations that are place-based within particular educational contexts. So we're really working toward a developmental approach to secondary education from across the basic science, the pedagogical metabolism, and the teacher professional development, the policymaking, and then wrapping it all together into a conversation about what education needs to be.
When I was listening to the webinar yesterday, as somebody who used to be a professor of history and sociology and who worked with teachers about doing active history, I was interested in listening to the social studies history teacher who was connected to Candle yesterday, who was talking about how he was incorporating what he was learning into creating meaningful, active, intellectually engaging, and important historical study for his students.
And that teacher is working in a really exceptionally innovative school context. It's a school context that's grappling with a lot of complexity, extra complexity, because he's working in a system of high schools that are designed to support non-traditional students whose educational trajectories have been severely disrupted from the foster care system, from the prison system, from homelessness, from all kinds of complex problems. And for him to talk about reframing the educational opportunities he's providing to his students around helping them make meaning of the civic landscape as he's teaching history. It's really powerful.
There's lots of reasons why transcendent thinking is particularly relevant and
Exactly.
particularly necessary for students who, in different ways, have been treated to what, back in the 1990s, Jane Nitzer and Steinberg talked about as a curricula of control marked just by boredom,
Yeah.
apathy, and
Compliance.
compliance, exactly.
Right. To
And
what end? What's the point? Why do you need to know those things, right? Yeah. But I'll also say something else to that, David, though. We actually do show the young people in our project had witnessed many things in their communities. Some of them had witnessed quite a lot of dangerous things, crime, gang activity, other kinds of things. And we asked them, as part of the study, we asked them to tell us about those things, right? So they filled in standard questionnaires of the things they'd seen. And then we followed up with an interview and asked them about the things they'd seen. Why do you think those kinds of things happen in your neighborhood? What could be done to make the situation better? If you could be magically have an audience with the lawmakers and the people in charge of the community or the school or whatever group you want to say, what would you tell them you think your idea would be to make things better and why? And what we found is that kids talk to us in ways that mirrored the ways in which they made meaning in the standard interview about the 40 documentaries from around the world. So they talked to us in ways that had varying degrees of transcendence in the way they understood things. Some kids said things that were quite concrete. I just think all these bad people do bad things and they lose control of their emotions and it's out of control and just stay away from them, which is true. That's not incorrect, right? But then kids would also say things like, and but I think if you really want to do something about this, you have to understand that every human being has a history. Every person brings a story. And so there's something about this person's history or story that set them up to be in this situation. Maybe they don't feel like they were loved at home. Maybe they're joining this gang because they want to be part of something bigger than themselves and they don't have that. Like me, I have parents who love me, but maybe they didn't feel like that. So kids were talking in these transcendent ways. And what we found is that, first of all, devastatingly, exposure to violence in the community, even though these kids were not direct victims or direct perpetrators, exposure to violence, just knowing about violence in the community, even across the 2-year span in mid to late adolescence, so 14 to 18 years old to 16 to 20 years old, right, produced measurable, or I should say, was associated with measurable neurodevelopmental structural effects, cortical loss of cortical volume across all kinds of affective and physiological and regulatory attention-related regions in the brain. So we think that our 18-year-olds are able to be tough and not be influenced by these things. Our study suggests that's just not true at all. And that's controlling for the violence that they had seen as a younger child before they started the study, and also controlling for the starting state of their brain development. So the additional witnessing of violence in the 2-year interval between the 2 visits to the lab was associated with statistically significant thinning and loss of cortical volume all over the brain, many places in the brain. But simultaneously, there was a positive effect on brain development of transcendent thinking. So the more a young person grappled to try to make bigger institutional level meaning out of the things they were seeing, grappled to try to take multiple perspectives on the problem, grappled to try to understand the broader reasons why and the broader suggestions for how to support people differently so that they don't end up in situations like this, those kids showed an independent effect of protection against cortical loss in their brain. So the two things were interacting with each other in the brain development. So transcendent thinking is actually protective against community violence exposure, is what our study suggests.
Rich, I think you have something you want to ask.
Mary Helen, David, and I interviewed a group of kids, and I found that the richness of the and uniqueness of the comments came after two or three of the kids in a group would say something that they thought the adults wanted to hear. And then they started commenting and building off each other's. So by the third and fourth and fifth person, we were getting unique thinking. How does that square with what you guys found or how you did things?
Yeah, so the way that we did the study, because we were going to want to have a predictive measure of the future, the way that we did the study was we talked to each kid individually. So that's a different kind of study than a very valid approach would be to look at how kids are working together, playing off each other, taking perspective, right? That's wonderful. And we do work like that in classrooms with teachers who are working with us in our co-lab programs, for example, looking at the ways that their young people are engaging with one another and looking at the ways teachers turn kids toward each other as sources of assets and information and ways to extend their own thinking. But in this study, we really needed to carve the person out of the context a little bit in order to be able to get a sense of, in this context, which was very carefully designed to be comfortable, to be inviting, right? We had research assistants who were from roughly the same ethnic and language background as each participant there on the day they were there. It was made to be very informal and fun, and we spent the whole day with them. We fed them lunch and we talked to them about all kinds of things. And kids love to tell you what they think if they really believe that you care to listen, right? And so we earned the kids' trust. And then I'll tell you that not one kid in the 2-hour interview with those stories, not one kid took a bathroom break in the middle, right? They were fascinated. At first, they were a little stinted. I think that's sad and poor her. But then they start just going, and then they realize we're really cared to hear what they have to say, and they start to really think about and grapple with things. And kids were deeply moved with the stories. We actually originally, when we did a version of this kind of experiment with adults, and we did it with young adults at USC and in China at Beijing Normal University, and we've done all kinds of ways of studying this, we found that with the teenagers, we had to reduce the number of stories from 50 to 40 because they would spend so much time really engaging and asking questions about them and wanting to really follow up. And what happened next? What are you telling me that they don't get to go to school, but are there school? They wanted to know about things. I remember one kid asked me, it was a story about an immigrant, a young adult who was undocumented but didn't know it. So he had been brought to the United States as a toddler. And with papers that were fraudulent, but he never knew that. And something happened in his 20s where this suddenly got revealed. And he was, by that time, you might have seen this person. He outed himself in the media. He was a Time magazine author and reporter or something like that with a journalism degree. And he did this expose on himself and his own story. And then he featured the stories of all these other kids and similar young adults in similar situations without revealing their identities. And it was about how he came to know that he was not documented legally and all these things. And so the kid is thinking about that and then just stops and says, "Can I ask a question?" I'm like, "Of course. Why do we do it that way? Like this, we draw this line in the dirt and we decide that people who are born on that side, they can only do things over there and people over here can go over there and we can control who goes back and forth across the line and you're not allowed to be on this side. Only that. Why do we do it that way? That doesn't seem like the best way to do it." You know what I mean? I could think causes a lot of trouble. I could think of better ways that we could organize. And that's a kid who's just wondering, right? That kid is like, why do we have borders the way we have borders? Like, I don't think that makes sense. Why do we do it that way? But that's just from the heart. The kid is just grappling to understand what's going on. And those kinds of things were what we counted as transcendent thinking. He's not just saying, "Oh, that poor guy, this happened, that's not fair. He's undocumented, he didn't know it, he shouldn't get in trouble because he didn't know it, and blah, blah, blah." Right? He's saying, "Wait, can I just ask, why is the system designed this way? What's the intention there?" That's transcendent thinking. And kids are deeply engaged. They're deeply driven, even emotionally, to do that. And what we also found that was very interesting that's related is that in the scanner, even statistically significantly, when kids pushed a button to tell us after each story, they had a little reminder of the story video for 5 seconds and then a long gray screen to just think about it. And at any time, they could push a button to tell us how strongly emotionally engaged they were with thinking about the story, how moved they were by it, how whatever that means to them. And we made very clear, don't tell us what you said before, what you think we think you should say, or any of that. Tell us how you feel right now. That's what we want to know. Okay. So kids did. And they push buttons from, I'm not that interested in this. I'm not that moved by it. I'm done thinking with it, all the way up to, I'm overwhelmed with emotion right now. I can hardly keep from crying in the scan or something like that. Right. And what we found is that those button press values, the strength of emotion, statistically moderated the real-time trial-by-trial correlation between the brain activity dynamics and the story, the answer they had given to their reaction to that story in the interview before they got in the scanner. In other words, when they had spoken transcendently about a particular story, we could predict that there were particular neural dynamics that would happen in their brains when they saw that story again, compared to the kinds of neural dynamics they would show to other stories that they hadn't thought transcendently about. And we could predict that brain activity even more reliably if we took into account that they told us they were feeling deeply emotional about it. The emotion was driving and organizing the transcendent thinking. And I think that's really a highlight of what transcendent thinking is. It's emotionally motivated, it's engaged, and it pertains to things that feel powerful and like they matter.
Mary Helen, is the reason I got into this stuff, okay? I left the work I was doing and to do it was I was interested in changing opportunities and outcomes
Yeah, I
for
know.
the for and I, in this case here, it is those kids, but not because I see them as those kids, but because I see them as my kids. But the
Exactly.
ones
They
who,
are your kids. I mean, it's an incredible
and I
story,
was
yeah.
almost one of them, okay? And by the way, everything you're talking about and everything we know about the brain and emotion really fits into me, but I'm also an example of everything you're talking about, including how reading books can lead you in the wrong direction as well as the right direction if you
Yeah,
read them
that's
passionately.
why you need transcendent thinking is amazing, but you need adults around
Yeah.
to steer you. We're not thinking we're going to send kids off into the yonder and let them do it all themselves. They need to
Yeah.
share their thinking and be responsible for those ideas. Why do you think that, right? And do you think she'd agree? Transcendent thinking is both an outcome that we measured, but it's really a process and it's a disposition.
Yeah.
And that's where we need to be thinking about.